You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis, and today's journey begins under these giant sprinklers on a farm on the northern border of San Diego County. It is a small, quiet patch of land that shares a border with the loud 15 freeway nearby. Now, water bounces off rows of black plastic stretched over soil. If you look closely, the plastic is dotted with holes, and tiny green leaves are just beginning to peek out.
Strawberries are one of the most perishable, delicate things that we could have chose to grow. It's a crapshoot. It is gambling, essentially. And some years we make some money, and some years we lose some money, and some years we're just happy to break even.
Kenny Feetz owns Kenny's Strawberry Farm, and he might be the world's biggest fan of strawberries.
I love it. I do. I love it. I stubbornly love it, you know. As hard as it is, it's very rewarding. I know. I'm, like, so nerdy. I'm a strawberry nerd.
But many of Kenny's strawberries will wind up going to waste. In the United States, 40% of food that could be eaten is tossed out. Wasted food comprises nearly a quarter of stuff in the landfill, and there it decomposes and releases 8% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. But this is one of those environmental issues that you can do something about, starting at the grocery store and ending in your refrigerator. This week on our series called Wasted, KCRW's Frances Anderton and Kaylee Wells tell us how.
Hey, I'm Kaylee Wells. So, when it comes to food production, California is America's Garden of Eden. The Golden State produces more than 80% of the country's tomatoes, apricots, avocados, dates, figs, kiwis, olives, plums, prunes, raisins, blackberries, raspberries, tangerines, wine grapes, and strawberries.
That's an incredible list, Kaylee, and I'm Frances Anderton. Hello, and the question here is, how much of all of this actually winds up being eaten? It turns out that getting all this bounty from the farm to the table is quite a complicated journey.
And we're going to take you on that journey. In fact, chances are a strawberry picked on Kenny Feetz's farm is not going to get eaten.
That's right, and it's because his little strawberries have to win a kind of beauty contest.
Anything that's too big, too small, too weirdly shaped, or not red enough doesn't get picked.
I'm a little obsessive about our quality and making sure that we're picking perfect strawberries. So we do train all of our pickers in terms of exactly the color, because with strawberries, there's nothing more important than the color of the strawberry.
So he says that in a good year, he might wind up with between 2 and 3 pounds of strawberries per plant that he can sell as whole and ready for the table. But actually, that plant had in fact produced twice as much, probably more like 4 to 4.5 pounds of fruit.
Well, all I can say is that I feel bad for those rejected strawberries.
Oh, it's okay, Frances, don't worry, because actually those imperfect-looking strawberries are, of course, still perfectly safe to eat, so they get turned into frozen berry smoothie medleys and jams.
Mmm, yum.
Yeah, and then the rest get left in the furrows, but they're plowed under to feed the next generation of strawberries.
Hmm, well, that sounds pretty good.
Yeah, but now it gets treacherous. At the grocery store, there is an enticing pile of strawberries, but 1 in 10 of them won't get sold.
1 in 10? And I believe that that's a strategic move. Is that right, Kaylee? Because the grocery stores lose more money in the long run if they run out of something.
Exactly. I mean, just think about how detrimental it would be for a grocery store to run out of avocados on Super Bowl Sunday. Here's how Andrea Collins puts it. She focuses on sustainable food systems for the Natural Resources Defense Council.
Grocery stores are overstocking and trying to give an impression of abundance that is leading to waste. So whether that's having a very tall mound of apples, the apples on the bottom are getting bruised and damaged.
But it turns out that grocery stores are much more innovative than you might think. Take Ralph's, for example. They have a bunch of strategies to not waste food. Those bruised apples at the bottom might be turned into sliced apples in a pre-made salad, or overripe strawberries could turn into a strawberry shortcake. Here's John Votava, the director of corporate affairs at Ralph's.
What we do is the food that we have in our stores, if it's getting up to its code dates and we know we are not able to sell it, we mark it down, move it to our clearance area. When that does not sell, that's when it becomes a donation.
Like to a food bank?
Right. But if something's gotten to the point that it's truly inedible, it has one more chance to avoid the landfill.
And this is where technology enters in. Food waste might wind up going to a gigantic machine that treats unloved strawberries like fuel.
Rouse and Food for Less built what's called an anaerobic digester. And we have this at our Compton Distribution Center. And this functions like a giant stomach. So what it does is you dump in the food into a grinder, which grinds up the food. It's mixed with runoff water from our creamery that's on site. And when that turns that all into a slurry.
So in the machine, all that old food morphs into two things, compost and methane.
Methane being that greenhouse gas that's emitted by decomposing food.
But instead of releasing that methane into the atmosphere, Ralph's puts it to good use.
And over time, through biology, it breaks down into a gas, a methane gas that we use to power generators that provides a portion of the energy at our distribution center. So, and then some of the solid waste that comes out of that is turned into this very rich organic mulch that we can share with our farmer partners that provide us produce.
And that rich organic mulch fuels the growth of new produce, and the methane provides about 20% of the electricity that is needed to keep the lights on at the site there in Compton. So these machines seem like a good answer, aren't they, Kaylee?
Well, yes and no. Aww. The state of California had hoped to see these anaerobic digesters spring up all over the state as an answer to reaching its lofty food waste diversion goals,
which were 75% by 2020.
But clearly we didn't hit that goal, and today there's only a few of those digesters. There's this one in Compton and an onion digester in Oxnard. It turns out they're expensive and the taxpayers just don't love funding them.
So does that mean that really it's best to just not create the methane and the food waste in the first place?
Exactly, which means the best end to our strawberry story is human consumption. But to get there, it still has to make it through the most dangerous part of its journey yet.
In the U.S. and in North America, more food is wasted at the household level than at any other part of the food supply chain.
Andrea Collins is right. Think about what you see when you open your fridge. Rotting vegetables, moldy strawberries.
That poor little strawberry.
I know. And Americans don't eat about 40% of the food that they buy. On average, that's $1,600 worth of produce per year. Can you imagine, Frances, just tossing $1,600 into the landfill every year?
It's crazy, and I can certainly attest to it. There's too much rotting food in our household. But here's something I'm curious about, Kaylee. Why would Ralph's care more about saving food than us regular householders?
Well, Andrea says it's because
businesses are incentivized to make the most of their resources in a way that households don't have that same time or energy to be able to do.
Businesses pay per ton of trash they send to the landfill, while most of us don't pay by weight. We simply pay monthly to have a trash can that gets dumped once a week, regardless of how much is in there. And let's add that food just isn't as expensive as it was for, say, our grandparents. Americans spend less than 10% of their income on food in 2019. 60 years ago, it was nearly 18%.
But that's still 10%, Kaylee. It's not nothing.
No, you're right, it's not. But we can change that without sweeping new laws or expensive programs. Andrea says you just need to tweak your shopping habits.
Things like planning what you're going to eat before you go to the store and checking what you have in your pantry. Shopping your fridge before you shop at the store to make sure that you're purchasing things that you're going to need, and then sticking with your plan so that when you've brought the food into your home, you're actually using all of it.
And finally, if you buy some of Farmer Kenny Feetz's strawberries, eat them up. He's hoping people remember fruit doesn't just magically turn up at the grocery store. That's what he tells kids who visit on school field trips.
And they come out here and they realize that strawberries don't come in this perfectly sterile little clean plastic package from the grocery store, that they actually do. We battle bugs and diseases and weather and, you know, everything you can imagine.
And we've got more tips on how to keep your food from spoiling at kcrw.com/greaterLA. For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells.
And I'm Frances Anderton, and this was the third in our series looking at neat solutions to a dirty problem of waste. Next week, we're going to meet the folks at Homeboy Electronics Recycling, where they're giving e-waste and people a second chance.
kids heading to farmer Kenny Feetz's strawberry farm aren't the only ones learning where their produce comes from. In recent years, new places of learning have begun to pop up all around Los Angeles, offering kids a chance to learn about growing food and minimizing waste and everything in between. Deshonda Giles-Jones teaches 6th to 8th grade at what's called Environmental Charter Middle School in Inglewood, and she joins me right now to talk about this newish movement. Hi, Deshonda.
Hello. Hello. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. I mean, I want to start with the name of your school, Environmental Charter School. What does that mean?
Yeah, so we are a network of three schools located in South Los Angeles. We have one high school and two middle schools, hopefully to open a second high school in the next couple of years. And Environmental Charter School is just as it sounds. We utilize the environment as a vehicle to engage students, get them out into their communities, to learn about the issues we're facing as citizens, and to learn how to be active agents in change right where they are locally.
So it's a school, but is it like reading, writing, and recycling?
Absolutely all of those. We are a school. We are a charter school. We are a public charter school that's open to anyone. And what that means is they're getting their regular academic classes, their core classes of English, history, math, science. What we do that's so special is we are very interdependent and interdisciplinary. So we all work through the lens of the environment to teach our students those basic academic features.
Most of the students, Deshonda, from Inglewood entering the school, do they have much experience with gardening or growing their own food? Is this something new for them?
Their exposure to gardening or environmental issues is very slim. I do see more of an influx of this kind of education on different levels within elementary, but for the most part, not the way they're getting it in our school. It is very infused. We are outside more than we are inside. And when I say in my class they're learning how to garden, they are actually taking care of our campus because we don't have just one garden. Our entire campus is a living campus. So everywhere we can plant a tree or grow food is being utilized. So it's very different for them. I often get with students when they first come to my class, like, why are we learning this? And why am I weeding for a grade? Why am I learning how to collect water for a grade? You know, so it's a little different for them. But by the time they leave us in eighth grade, and if, you know, we're lucky to keep them all the way through high school, you can see a big difference in the way they interact with the earth and nature.
Do you get a lot of pushback from people saying, we don't need this kind of school? We need, you know, we need the basics. We need to teach people how to read and to write and to do the things that will help them get a job later in life. I mean, this other stuff is unnecessary. I mean, I'm speaking, you know, like I can imagine there could be some pushback to something like this.
Yeah, you know what? I think you're absolutely correct. I think depending on where you are in our nation, you would definitely find some pushback because it is a newer frontier. You're going to get pushback from a community side, but you do get pushbacks from families as well because there hasn't been an emphasis on this kind of very essential education. There hasn't been an emphasis on understanding, let's say, where our food comes from. Because we have such access in a lot of places, not always in every place. So for the population of students that we teach, it was essential that this type of education was something that we could deliver because it directly impacted the way that they were living their lives. So when people are able to now see that we have a generation, not just one, several generations who are so disconnected from where food comes from, it's time that we take a pause because we can see it impacting our nutrition. We can see it impacting communities in a way that they don't even understand they're living in food deserts or what that even means. And so when we say we're teaching interdependence and interconnectedness around systems and ideas, this is what we're talking about. And this is the type of education that's needed if we're going to combat those huge issues like climate change. We have to change minds and hearts when they're young, and we have to instill skills and practices in these students also while they're young.
And by the way, we're talking about waste as far as food goes. I mean, if you're talking about a solution, or at least a partial solution, which is composting this food, right? To not throw it, not making it wind up in a landfill, but putting it in a compost pile with dirt and let it sort of biodegrade on its own, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do you get kids psyched on that? I mean, is it the worms? Is it playing in the dirt? Because I mean, I could be into that, right?
Well, that's really interesting. You would be amazed how many students come to me who have never played with a worm, who have never played in dirt and soil. I mean, again, we're located in an urban city. There's not like there's a lot of dirt or soil to dig around in. So when we talk about food, there's so many ways to connect students to how our food is grown and how that food is consumed and then how the waste from food is disposed of. So we do start with worms, and I make my students touch worms with no gloves in the beginning and their parents and our teachers, everyone, because I loved playing with worms when I was little, but worms are very important.
You can't play with worms on Zoom, which is kind of where we are right now, right?
Right.
I mean, how do you get them involved virtually instead of in person with you know, dirty hands?
Oh, yes. The challenge of how to teach a course like this that's very hands-on virtually. A lot of it has always been about behavior change once again, but a lot of it has turned into an inspiration, getting these kids to emotionally and mentally connect to the work. And the way that I've been able to actually keep their hands in soil is I send home garden kits to my students every semester. So they actually get to grow independently, but we do it all together. So they get kits where they get to grow at least 3 to 4 different varieties of food. And as we're going through our lessons in the semesters, we are engaging in that project of growing. So it gives us an opportunity to talk about soil, it gives us an opportunity to talk about nutrition. It even gives us that opportunity to talk about worms.
Tashonda Giles-Jones, who teaches over at Environmental Charter Middle School in Englewood. Tashonda, thanks for taking the time out. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis, and now to another world. In just a few weeks, the newest exploration device that'll traverse the surface of Mars will make its debut on the Red Planet. Back in July, the rover called Perseverance rocketed off from Cape Canaveral. It was a 6-month journey. Oh, how much has changed on Earth in half a year. And now Perseverance is closing in on its planet of choice. Scheduled touchdown, February 18th. And NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, based right here in Greater LA, is overseeing the mission. Keith Como is Mars 2020 Mission Manager over at JPL, and he's with us right now. Hey, Keith.
Hey, Steve. Great to be with you.
Thank you for joining us today. Earth, I know, is obviously tens of millions of miles away from Mars. How far will this journey be for Perseverance when all is said and done?
By the time we reach Mars, we will have traveled 292 million miles from Earth. Ooh. To Mars.
And more than 6 months, right?
That's right.
Journey. So how fast is it traveling?
So that's an interesting question. It depends on what your point of reference is. But our spacecraft right now is traveling about 57,000 miles per hour relative to the Earth. It's traveling about 5,600 miles per hour relative to Mars, and relative to the sun, it's traveling a whopping 49,000 miles per hour.
So it could get a ticket, right?
I mean, absolutely.
What's the speed limit out there? It's not 55, I'm sure.
It's the speed of light.
It's the speed of light, exactly. Tell us about the landing. All right, so it's going so fast, but it gets a little janky, right, when it tries to land on Mars.
Right. So as we approach Mars, we're going to fall into its gravity well, and our speed relative to Mars at that point will accelerate to about 12 or 13,000 miles per hour relative to the planet. And so when we hit the atmosphere, we'll be going pretty fast, and we'll have to slow down all the way to zero 7 minutes later by the time we reach the surface. And so there's a pretty elaborate sequence of events that happens in those 7 minutes, beginning with the deceleration that the entry capsule affords us. When we hit the top of the atmosphere for about 3 minutes or so, we'll decelerate from about that 12,000 miles per hour to about 1,000 miles per hour. And we'll also be doing some bank reversals through the atmosphere during that period of time to zero in on our landing target and to land in Jezero Crater.
So let's keep fingers crossed, right, that everything goes as planned and smoothly. Once it gets down there, what's it going to do?
Once it arrives over the Jezero Crater, we'll deploy the parachute, and we'll start taking pictures of the landing site and look for a safe place to land. And we'll release from the parachute and then fly our descent stage all the way to the surface and use the sky crane, as we did for Curiosity, to put the rover on the surface. Jezero Crater is a very interesting landing site selection. It's a crater that the scientists have determined was once filled with water. There's an inlet channel and an exit channel. And so that implies there was an ancient lake there at some time in the past. So it makes for a very interesting site for searching for possible signs of past habitability, or even possibility of finding evidence of ancient life.
And the rover has wheels, right? So it's going to be able to move along the Martian surface. Can you see anything from above? Is it just you're exploring from ground level, or will you be seeing anything else?
Well, there's several orbiters that are flying over that are taking pictures regularly over the surface. Once we're on the ground, though, we'll use the suite of cameras that we have. Our robotic mast is about 7 feet above the ground, and we've got five cameras up there. They're high definition zoom cameras that can take pictures from a far distance. We also have an imager that can take microscopic or very close-up images of rocks from a distance, rocks that we intend to shoot with lasers that are also up there on the mast. We also have a technology demonstration component of our mission is a Mars helicopter.
A helicopter.
That's right. So this will be a first in the history of Mars exploration, the first actual flight in an atmosphere, not the Earth, and another planet. That helicopter itself has a camera in it. And one of the objectives will be to take some images with that helicopter flying above the surface and return those to Earth.
Is it going to be like, you know, looking at a police chase?
Well, I don't
maybe think... a traffic report.
That's funny. Actually, things don't happen so fast on Mars. Our rover does not move very fast, and although the helicopter has the capability of moving quite a bit, our battery charge is pretty small, so our flight durations will only last a minute or so.
When are we ever going to have people on Mars, Keith? Astronauts or even colonization? Are we talking hundreds of years before anything like that can happen? Or,
well, that's something we all look forward to. People have made projections on when that might happen, and they've all been wrong. So I'm hopeful that it'll happen in my lifetime, that we'll have humans stepping foot on Mars. But it takes a real commitment and a lot of technology development. So it's really hard to predict something like that.
We've got other rovers on the planet too, right? I know we lost track of Opportunity, but Sojourner was on there, right? What are the other ones? Because there were quite a few.
That's right. So Sojourner was the U.S.'s first Mars rover. It landed in 1997. It lasted for about a month or so. Spirit and Opportunity landed in 2004. They far outlived their warranty of 90 days and lasted many, many years beyond that. Curiosity landed in 2012. I worked on that mission. It's still operating. It's going strong. And Perseverance is our next rover.
Keith Como is Mars 2020 Mission Manager at JPL over in La Cañada, Flint Ridge, and Pasadena. Keith, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Good to be with you, Steve.
That's all we have for you this evening. Tomorrow, the vaccines may be here, but my goodness, is it tough to get one and figure out who's eligible? We're going to try and help tomorrow on this program. Go online, check us out at kcrw.com/greaterLA. It's a simple website there. You can subscribe to the podcast and tell us how you're doing as well. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Desmond Taylor, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Mario Saavedra, Amy Tom, Mike Stark, and Christian Bordahl all had hands on today's show. Thanks for your ears and attention this evening. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Have a great night.